Welcome to session 113, Civil Rights in the RLDS Church in the 1960s, a personal memoir by Bill Russell. Many of you know Bill. He's an old, not old, he's a long-time favorite.
76 is old.
A long-time favorite Sunstone presenter. He's also the past president of the Mormon History Association and the John Wimber Association. He is a professor emeritus at Graceland University, and he's been gracing us with his presence at Sunstone since about 1984. If you haven't had a chance to get down to the book room yet, I know that you will later. He's got at least one book down there that he's edited. There's a bunch of others, too. Bill will be talking about civil rights, and I just have to say why I asked to chair this session, other than the fact that it's Bill. They say that if you don't remember the 60s, you didn't live through it. And I don't remember the 60s, but I did live through them. I was born in the late 60s and actually studied the 60s as one of my college classes. I had a seminar, and it was really a lot of fun. But I kind of grew up on this whole civil rights thing, so and seeing the Mormon church from Salt Lake dragging its feet and seeing, we'll see what happens. I'd like to see what the Community of Christ, RLDS, did. So just as a reminder, this is the first session of the day. Make sure you silence your cell phones now. You're going to get reminded the rest of the day. You might as well check that right now. We will be recording this session, and as people come in, we'll make space for them if we need to.
Yeah, it might be short on space.
Yeah. You know, this is a popular session, but it takes a while to get up the stairs. So we'll get up there, and after Bill is done, I think he'll take questions. You're free to come up to this center microphone. If you're feeling really brave, you can come and grab one of these from the table here. So, Bill, it's all yours.
Thank you. Well, I was delighted when I saw that Laura was going to be chairing this because I have such a high regard for Laura and Todd and Nadine and Zachary and Wesley. And so Zachary, I think, may have been about the youngest person to attend Sunstone. For about 3 months after Grant McMurray resigned as president of the Community of Christ, late in 2004, there was a time when the top leaders of the church, mainly the 12, invited anyone to send in names of persons who ought to be considered to be the new prophet president of the church. There was no apparent limitation on who could nominate somebody, so I suppose Gordon B. Hinckley submitted one. But anyway, I had a good friend who had been a very prestigious leader, very prominent in the church, RLDS Church, as a stake president in several places. And then he became a member of the First Presidency of the Remnant Church, one of the splinter groups. And so one morning, the phone rings, and Dave was asking if it'd be all right if he sent in my name to be president and prophet of the church. I thought, well, it probably pays a little better than when I'm getting into full professor at Graceland. There'd be lots of travel, like in the Army, see the world, but without anybody shooting at you, at least probably not. And you get lots of respect. You get to tell the whole world what the church has been thinking lately, and that'd be cool. And you get to give lots of orders. So I said, sure, Dave, go ahead. And they say there are 17 nominees, and I don't know if I was seriously considered or not. Well, I guess I do, but it's clear now that they found Stephen Vesey to be the superior candidate. But I want you to know, I speak with the authority of a nominee for president prophet. When my granddaughter Kylie was about four, I remember it as six, but she says, no, I was about four. We would play a game at my house where we'd chase each other through the three rooms in the upstairs and make a circle. And whenever a person caught up with the other person from behind, they won. And so each time Kylie would run downstairs and report to our family members downstairs. And so So one time, about the fifth time, she always won for some reason, and about the fifth time she started to head down the stairs, and so I said, going downstairs to brag? And she replied emphatically, not bragging, just reporting. And I'll come back to that later. Through the years, the churches of America have had to confront controversial social and political issues which raised moral and ethical questions like poverty, war, peace, and prison reform, capital punishment, other issues, which are moral issues. And Christian churches needed to address these issues if they wanted their gospel to be authentic. I know that for the LDS Church, the racial problem was quite difficult. I became a member of the Mormon History Association in 1971, and I saw how pained many of my friends were about the priesthood ban. And I know there were many tears of joy shed in 1978. Now, I'm not here to brag about the RLDS Church. I know some of you probably think, well, we handled a whole lot better than you guys did, and maybe so, but it's a matter of degree and not of kind. The issue of racial discrimination and segregation confronted the church especially hard after World War II, when white Americans began to wake up to and realize the depth of racial discrimination in the country. But Israel A. Smith, president from 1946 to 58, and his successor, his half-brother, W. Wallace Smith, 58 to 78, did not see any need for the church to address the race issue because they thought the church had not had any discrimination and did not need to have anything to say about it. But some church members wrote articles in the various papers of the magazines of the church, the Official Saints Herald, the Youth Magazine Stride, the college student publication, call it the University Bulletin. And many members were aware of racial discrimination, which led to general conference resolutions in 1948 in 1956, which brought the church's official policy somewhat in line with enlightened thought on race. This paper is simply a look at the racial issue in the RLDS Church in the years I was at Grace in that six-year period, which was the peak of the civil rights movement. And I was an editor, and just great job fell in my hands right out of Graceland. It's amazing. I thank Roger Yarrington to my death to give me that job. This paper is simply a look at how the church dealt with the issue, and somewhat people in Independence who may or may not have been members of the church during those years I was an editor. These were the peak years, as they say, and I had attended a very working class high school in Flint, Michigan, where about a third of the students were black, but most important for me, most of my teammates on the track team were black. Our family had finally bought a television in my senior year in high school, which happened to be the year of the Montgomery bus boycott. And I got acquainted with this brilliant, articulate, a young preacher named Martin Luther King, who led the boycott. I became a disciple of his, and perhaps that was partly because of the prejudice I saw on television in Montgomery, made me think of my friends, many of whom had moved up from some southern cities like Montgomery, Alabama. And also my father was a full-time paid church appointee minister for the church, and I saw how King's message was deeply rooted in the Christian scripture and tradition. So in 1960, when I just graduated and had this incredible good luck to get this job, editing Stride, the youth magazine, and assistant editor of the Herald. By 1963, I was in the middle of the racial skirmishes in the church and in the Independence area. And I have saved many letters, and some of which I stole from the files, because I knew they were going to throw them away, and other documents from those years. In my first year, I asked an elder who was an African-American and pastor of a racially segregated congregation in Pensacola, Florida, to write an article for Stride. He wrote, "A Negro Pastor Looks at Brotherhood," which I published as a lead article in the May 1961 issue. That's the article from Stride that I'm the most proud of. He was very candid. It was really a gutsy thing to do for an African-American man living in the Deep South in the Florida Panhandle. I was inspired by the activities and skirmishes of the 1960s and wrote several articles and editorials in the Herald and Stride and the University Bulletin. And also, I published letters in the Independence Examiner and Kansas City Star. After the March on Washington, I teamed up with an older African-American woman, Virginia Jacobs, to form the Independence chapter of CORE, the Congress of Racial Equality. Only four other whites participated to any extent. And RLDS folks here would recognize the name of Wilford Windholz. He was one of those other whites. In 1963 and 65, when the civil rights movement was really at its peak, I wrote my two most controversial editorials in the church's official publication, the Herald. One on the Birmingham demonstration in 63, and the other on the Selma March in 65. Two things I wrote in the spring of 63, one of which was that editorial, were probably what first brought me to the attention of the First Presidency and others of the church, not always in a favorable light. I have about 20 incidents in this paper, but I'm going to have to omit some of them for time. Incident number one, my letter in the local paper on interracial marriage. The first incident in 63, which ushered me into the limelight in Independence, and not favorably, especially not favorably in this one, was my letter published in the Independent Examiner. I had read a letter to the editor in the Examiner by Troy Niffen, saying that if he had married a Negro, his grandfather would be spinning in his grave. He also asserted that the solution to the race problem was to ship Negroes back to Africa and whites be brought from Africa to the USA. I was greatly troubled by the fact that this letter writer was presumably a church member because he had published some poetry in the Saints Herald. So my letter was in support of interracial marriage. I said, if two people desire to be married and meet all the normal qualifications of marriage, why shouldn't a society, including the church, add its blessings regardless of the race of the couple? I found out soon that interracial marriage was not particularly popular in and around Independence, Missouri, a city that this young man from the north in Michigan, the north, was quite a, seemed like quite a southern town to me. I suppose it was fortunate that on the Friday my letter was published, I had left Independence for a week-long church camp, older youth camp at Graceland. When I got back, our managing editor, Paul Wellington, told me that there's been a lot of criticism flying around the offices and the shop the previous week. One employee said that, poor Bill, he has ruined any ministry he might ever provide for the church in the future. At that time, there were about 19 states which still outlawed interracial marriage. 4 years later, the Supreme Court ruled that in Loving versus Virginia, appropriate name, that it was unconstitutional. Polls at that time would show something like 80 to 90% of white Americans were opposed to interracial marriage. Loving versus Virginia illustrates about as well as anything that it's the job of the American courts to protect the rights of unpopular minorities who can never get to their state legislatures or Congress to protect their rights. The parallels to the current struggle in the church and society over same-sex marriage are obvious, but basic human rights in the Constitution are not subject to a vote of the people. When do you think Mississippi finally repealed their slavery statutes that became unconstitutional in 1965? Try the 1990s. It only took them 130 years or so. my hero in Iowa state politics is the Democratic majority leader in the Senate. The Republicans were clamoring to have a popular vote to overturn the Iowa Supreme Court decision on gay marriage. And Mike, you only had one vote margin, not as long as I'm the majority leader in the Senate. And he still is. He's been there for 6 years five years since it happened. Incident number two, my editorial on Martin Luther King. The other 1963 incident was an editorial I wrote for the Saints Herald in the spring of 65 following the Birmingham demonstrations. And I followed them closely and wrote this editorial. Martin Luther King, Saint, Satan or Saint? That seems like a weird title now. But we forget that King was very unpopular with white Americans, basically, until he died, or pretty close to it. it was 5 years later that he would die. So I wrote, were there not a prophetic voice like Dr. King's speaking out for nonviolent resistance to racial discrimination, the most likely alternative would be violence. Then I quoted Dr. King, violence by creating many more social problems than it solves never brings permanent peace. And I concluded, let us not be silent on this issue. The First Presidency received some communications from various saints around the church objecting to my editorial. Milo Barnhart of Independence, Missouri, apparently a really nice guy because he wrote a very respectful letter to the editor. But he said, in 5 years, whites will be under Negro domination. Have you noticed that for the last 40, 50 years or so? well, we have a black president, don't we? We need to go slow, as Doctrine and Covenants 1:16 says. But then he said, But he wasn't angry. He just concluded, but let's be friends even though we disagree. So that's not the only really pleasant solution for it. I mean, signing off a letter we received of these kinds of letters. Section 116 with Joseph Smith III in 1865 saying, we'll open the priesthood to Negro men. On August 4th...
1865?
1865, yeah. And the revelation was earlier that year, early in the year. On August 4th, 1963, Sister Mabel Erickson of Antioch, California wrote, claiming that the integration movement is communist-led, or inspired, we got a lot of that. Mm-hmm. I was called a communist many times myself. The communists are telling blacks that they've been oppressed, and to help the communists take over the world. My thought was, so blacks don't already know they've been oppressed. Well, thanks to the communists for telling them. Sister Erickson continued, we do live in a changing world, but we can pray that the Church of Jesus Christ will be one church which will not change. That good, yeah. Doesn't he say, I am the same yesterday, today, and forever? I don't know how long she lived, but she got a lot of disappointments. Because of my editorial, the First Presidency contacted Paul Wellington, our managing editor, talked to him about me and other things. And he said the First Presidency told Paul, the Herald should avoid appearing to endorse a political movement. Roger Yerington had taken a job, well, Paul Wellington replaced Roger Yerington as the managing editor because Roger left. Took another job. But Paul Wellington, to his credit, he never, ever refused to publish an editorial I submitted. In fact, he never made any kind of substantive changes, toning anything down or anything. So I really respect Paul Wellington, too. Number three, incident number three. President Smith thinks Martin Luther King's a communist. Paul, when he came back from that meeting, said that President Smith said that he thought that I was a communist. And he thought Martin Luther King was a communist, too. I was pleased to be in such good company, that's for sure. 16 years later, Morris Draper, the only real supporter of civil rights in his first presidency, had now retired from the presidency, and he spent the year at Graceland. And so one day, I told him that I understood that Martin Luther King, that President Smith, W. Wallace, thought Martin Luther King was a communist. And Draper said, I was surprised, Draper's candor was sometimes so refreshing. Draper said, worse than that, he thought King was a common criminal because King was willing to break the law. Draper said Wallace had no understanding of the strategy of civil disobedience. Draper had been very frustrated with President Smith during his 20 years as his counselor, and there was more than one occasion when he came awfully close to resigning, but he did finally chose to stick it out. I do think that Draper and other counselors sometimes talked President Smith into doing things he wasn't inclined to do, and I have great regard for them for that. Like on women, they really pushed him on women's issues, Draper and doing cooing. You could get a good taste of President Smith's thinking on civil rights by reading his editorial in the Saints Herald, November 15, 1962, entitled States' Rights and the Constitution. He seemed to be on the side of those who sought to protect segregation by appealing to states' rights, leaving the southern states to deal with the problems themselves. But the problem had been that since the Compromise of 1877, the federal government had left the race problem to the states and the role of blacks, the status of blacks in society, very soon diminished greatly after Reconstruction. So Wallace obviously didn't know history. I wonder what the heck he was reading about some of the things he thought and wrote. I want you to be sure to distinguish between W. Wallace Smith and his son Wally B. Wally B. and Grant McMurray and Steve Easy are quite a different character on these kinds of issues. I had never been enamored with the whole idea of lineal succession in the office of church president, the issue which, in addition to opposition to polygamy, were the two main issues when he split it from those fellows that went and gals that went west. So my experience at headquarters only confirm my view that lineal succession is not a way to go. We didn't break with that awful tradition until 1996, when Wally B., the good guy, named Anon Smith as his successor. Now, if you guys in Utah abandon your silly tradition of having the senior apostle assume the church presidency, don't go to the equally silly and absurd method of lineal succession that we have had until recently in our church. Now, brothers and sisters, can I hear an amen on that?
Amen.
Okay. Issue number four. The August 1963 editorial on race. In 1963, the first presidency decided to address the subject of race and the church, race in the church. So they wrote in an editorial entitled "Our Position on Race and Color" in the August 1st issue of the Herald. They should never have written that. This was clearly a response to my editorial on Martin Luther King 1 month earlier. The editorial whitewashed our experience with African Americans in the church, as both Wallace and his brother Israel had done, pretending we had no problems. Within a day or so, this is what I really appreciate about another church leader, within a day or so after that August 1st Saints Herald came out with their editorial, I got a phone call from Walter Johnson of the Residing Bishopric, telling me that the president's editorial was an embarrassment, which it was. He said the editorial is a whitewash of the situation in church, because he said in every place in the church today where we have had African American members, there have been problems. So I respect Walter. I mean, I suspect Walter just wanted to give me some encouragement, since he would know, as I knew, that that editorial was a response to mine. Incident number five, older youth meetings on civil rights at the Stone Church, 1963. I was named to a committee to plan the older youth activities at the Stone Church, our historic first church in Independence, each Sunday night during the summer of 63. I got the committee to agree to spend three sessions on civil rights, and I invited Morris Draper of the presidency, Dr. Dean Ferris, a University of Illinois biology professor, and had been at Grayson, had been my biology professor, and Lee Swinton, a black lawyer and head of the NAACP in Kansas City. At about the time of the first meeting, I received a copy in the mail of Martin Luther King's now famous letter from Birmingham City Jail, which he wrote while he was a guest of the correctional facilities of the city of Birmingham. To this day, I regard it as the best single document or speech to read of Dr. King's to understand his thinking. I was very impressed with his wisdom on the strategy in Birmingham, and most of all, I appreciate his discussion as to why it was sometimes necessary to break the law when seeking social change. I reread Dr. King's letter every Sunday afternoon before we're going to be talking about civil rights that night. Each night when we discuss civil rights, a young elder, recently moved up from Florida, named Lester Tankersley, came up and argued with the speaker with a large circle of young adults gathered around listening. I was really upset when he argued with Lee Swinton, the NAACP leader in Kansas City, a lawyer and an African-American, who I had invited to come and speak to this all-white young adult group. When Morris Draper spoke, Elder Tankersley approached him afterward, and I'll always appreciate the way Morris, a member of the First Presidency, was willing to engage this segregationist with a large circle of young adults gathered around. It was kind of like when there was a big playground fight and a circle, a big circle of kids gathered around to watch him duke it out. Finally, then, after about an hour, Elder Tankersley, on a hot July evening, had said that it was time. He said that what happened to Latin America. They've mongrelized the race. And at that point, Morris said, he reached over, picked up his coat, real hot night, taking off his tie, threw it over his shoulder, and said, "That was the most ethnocentric statement I've ever heard in my life." And he left. Incident number six. My debate with segregationist Tankersley at a church youth group. I had one other encounter with Tankersley. A couple of years later, my colleague at Herald House, June Hostler, was a leader of the high school youth group at high school age group at her congregation in Independence. And Mr. Tankersley was attending their congregation and stirring up the folks on racial segregation. So she asked me to come and debate him in front of this Zionist high school age group. So I did, and we had our debate. And Joe Pearson, who was now the editor of the youth magazine Stride, asked me and Lester Tankersley to submit our talks for publication side by side in the Youth Magazine. And so Lester brought in his 10-page article and gave it to Joe. And I could overhear the conversation from my office next door. And he said, now, I don't want you to make any changes in this document. I got it directly from God. And so Joe says, oh, then this should go in the Doctrine and Covenants. I'm not stride, you know, where he's going to put it. Brother Tankersley agreed that it should be added to the Doctrine and Covenants. But unfortunately for Elder Tankersley, the message from God still has not been published anywhere in the church. So. Issue number 6, the March on Washington. I'm going to skip that. Issue 8, Incident 8, my sermon at South Chrysler the weekend of the Kennedy assassination. When President Kennedy was assassinated on Friday, November 22nd, I was glued to our television set for the next 24 hours or so. Finally, on Saturday afternoon, I realized, oh, I got to preach tomorrow at South Chrysler. It's a large congregation, Independence. I'd only been there a year. It was the first time I'd been asked to speak, so I want to do a good job. And so, but I pulled out the notes I'd prepared early in the week. They made no sense now in light of the assassination. So I picked up Dr. King's book of sermons entitled Strength to Love and found a sermon entitled Shattered Dreams. It was perfect. That was just the sermon I needed. So I added a lot of my own material from the Kennedy assassination and from the King and the Kennedy assassination relating them. I received perhaps the best response of any sermon or any talk I ever gave. And I'm sure it was just the climate. The nation was in mourning and so forth. But the pastor thought I was a communist. The only two people I noticed weren't comfortable with the sermon as people came out. And that was only the pastor and the assistant pastor. I found out later that the pastor thought I was a commie. But after the service, my sister, Rita Lancaster, suggested that I publish my sermon in the Saints Herald. I said, I can't. It's copyrighted. About half of it, anyway. I've always believed, I want you to follow my instructions here. I've always going to believe you're going to steal a sermon or a sacrament talk or something, be sure and steal a good one. You've got a moral, moral obligation on that. Incident number 9, sermon by Martin Luther King, which I published in the Christian Leaders Journal. I was sensitive to the fact that many segregationists, including some church members, thought King was a communist. So I published his sermon, How Should a Christian View Communism, in our Priesthood and Leaders Journal, our leadership group, leadership magazine. And Sister Edith Odom from Alabama wrote saying, not objecting to using this, to me, all this will change when the Lord is ready. When the Negro people prepare and humble themselves, then we will, as a church, have further revelation to direct us. Apparently, once again, the victims are the ones that are responsible, the ones that need to repent. Incident number 10, the Church Bowling League is in a segregated alley. I'll skip that. Incident number 11, asking a theater owner if his theater was segregated gets me turned down for teaching the Old Testament class at our leadership school, the School of Restoration. That was interesting. I'll skip that. Issue number 12, the Civil Rights Act of 64. I'll skip it. Issue number 5, incident number 13. My editorial on the Selma March in 65. I got this perpetual cough coming over. I think it was when I crossed the line into the state of Utah. this editorial in the Herald on the Selma March, it was titled, They Died for a Cause. And I contended that those who died in Selma remind us of the early Christian martyrs who died for witnessing for Christ. We received a letter from Brother J. E. Sutton, Butler, Missouri, saying my editorial should not have been published because the Herald doesn't understand the situation in the South. Brother Sutton said that Apostle Donald Chesworth was recently at his house, and Sutton had shown him and read to him what was going on in the Selma March. Apparently, it was a traveling interracial sex orgy. That was the accusation I ever seen from other segregationists. All right, but they're trying to educate me, of course. And he said that Brother Sutton said that Apostle Chesterton said, well, it's worse than that, the apostle. And he said the Herald is making his job as the apostle to the South very difficult. Poor Don. Some other appointees handled the race issue much better, even though they're from the North. Issue incident 14. I hear a racist diatribe in a Baptist church in Zion. In the summer of 65, my state president and good friend, Wayne Updike, called and asked if I was interested in going to hear a man named Kenneth Goff speak at the Salisbury Hills Baptist Church in Independence. I recognized Goff as perhaps the best-known anti-Semitic demagogue on the American circuit of bigoted speakers who go around the country spreading poison. So I readily agreed to attend. Goff's speech was incredible. The Watts riots had been very recent, and at one point he said that blacks were waiting until sometime when a leader like Martin Luther King would give a signal, and blacks who were a majority of the population of Washington, D.C., would go in all the government offices and kill all the government officials and take over the country. For some reason, I'd taken notes throughout this diatribe. When I got home, I couldn't sleep, so I got up and I just typed a 4-page rebuttal to his speech. Now, I didn't think the Examiner would publish a long letter criticizing speech at a Baptist church. After all, the Baptists were the largest denomination in Independence, not the RLDS. I pretty much thought my letter as personal therapy after that terrible evening, and then I was finally able to sleep. But they published about 90% of it on their weekly Friday letters form. Number 15 is related to this. I get picketed at my workplace. These letters in the Examiner caught the attention of a man in Kansas City by the name of Wayne Morris, clearly not the liberal senator from Oregon. This Wayne Morris was a right-wing anti-communist fanatic. He was known for picketing about every known liberal in the Kansas City area, and I'd seen him several times picketing people. As it happened, Herald House had scheduled this open house, 3-day open house, in their new building on Nolan Road, shortly after this exchange in the Examiner letters. And so that Nolan Road is a business, I believe, a business street in Independence then, and now I believe Independence folks could correct me on that. Our open house went from 8 a.m. to 9 p.m., 13 hours each day. And all 13 hours each day, Mr. Morris was out there walking up and down in front of our Herald House with a sign, a very professional sign. The commies just love, and he slotted my name because he picketed many people before. The commies just love William D. Russell. Well, I felt affirmed. Who doesn't want to be loved, you know? Each day I would park at a place where I would be watching. Be walking right by Mr. Morris on my way to the office. He had never met me, although, of course, I knew who he was. And he would say, I would say, hello, sir. And he would give me a friendly greeting in response. I really regret now that I didn't think to ask him, Mr. Morris, tell me about Mr. Russell's communist associations. His response would have been very interesting to me, the subject of that. Now, the Wayne Morris incident was a humorous aside, but the encounter with Kenneth Goff in the exchanges in the Examiner by letter was very troubling. How could a church, Baptist or any other, invite Kenneth Goff to speak? I was glad it was not. He didn't speak in one of our congregations. Incident number 16. I put Bill Russell used cars out of business in Zion. A man named Bill Russell had a used car lot right next to the auditorium in Independence. And he feared that my notoriety in the community on civil rights was hurting his business. So he ran an ad in the Examiner every day for a week saying, let's clear the air. I am Bill Russell. And a picture, smiling Bill Russell. And I am not, capital N, capital O, capital T, underlined boldface, I am not the Bill Russell who's the vice chair of the Independence chapter of CORE. Apparently, I ran him out of business in Independence because before too long, he closed his Independence lot, leaving only his Kansas City lot there. That neighborhood is a very African-American neighborhood now, and his business is still there. But I don't know if the owner, Bill Russell, is still alive. But if not, I think I know where he is located at today. Incident number 17, fair housing in California. Skip that. Issue number 18, fair housing in Zion. Zion, of course, for your information, is Independence, Missouri. In 1965, an organization was formed by leaders from the Jewish, Catholic, and Protestant faiths to address racism in the Kansas City area. The RLDS Church was not involved in this group, so the executive secretary called me and asked me if I could attend meetings as an unofficial representative for the RLDS Church, hoping that I could bring the church into the fold. Well, when I can only get one stake president to come, the president said that's a local issue, so I contacted all four stake presidents. Only Garland Tickemeyer was willing to come. When he and I arrived, I introduced him to Rabbi Bill Silverman, who was the chairman, and he turned to Rabbi Sidney Lawrence of the Jewish Community Center and said, "Sid, this is Garland Tickemeyer of the Reorganized LSD Church." The organization decided that on a particular Saturday, we would go door to door, trying to cover all homes in the Kansas City area, asking the residents to sign a good neighbor pledge in which they promised not to discriminate on the basis of race whenever they sold their home. I was in charge of a precinct about 3 miles south of our church headquarters. As we gathered that Saturday morning, it looked like I didn't have nearly enough RLDS people, just as volunteers to cover the area that I was assigned. I was beginning to feel really depressed when up drove a carload of seminary students from a Catholic seminary at Conception Junction, Missouri. And now we had plenty of help to get to cover the neighborhood. If I ever thought that the Catholic Church was the great and abominable church, the whore of all the earth, I never thought it again. I hope I hadn't thought it before, but sometimes way back I might have. I received some hostile reactions when I went door to door, asking people to sign this good neighbor pledge. But there was no cursing, no spitting, no fisticuffs, and no shots fired. Now, in the Second Amendment hysteria today, it might be different with regard to shots being fired. The next week, I examined the list of people who had signed the petition and found that most of the men in the RLDS top leadership, the presidency and the 12 in the bishopric, were not on the list. But we could very easily miss a lot of them. So I sent each of the missing church leaders an envelope in the inner office mail within the headquarters and said that if they didn't get a chance to sign the pledge and they'd like to, or just send the card back to me and I'll submit their name. Two or three apostles returned the card with their signatures. We had four apostles out of 12. President W. L. Smith responded with a note. He's the only one who sent, other than two or three that added their name, the only rejection I got was from Wallace Smith. And he said, we did have someone stop at our house. So our prophet had declined to sign the Good Neighbor Pledge. It was a shock to me then, but perhaps shouldn't have been in light of what I really knew about him at that time. In the first presidency, only Morris Draper signed, 1 of 3, no surprise. In the presiding bishopric, only Walter Johnson, 1 of 3, no surprise. And 12 four of the 12 apostles signed, another 33% signing. We had a huge spread in the Kansas City Star with several pages containing thousands of names. There were many good Christian folks in Zion and the region roundabout in those years. Number 19, I get challenged to a fight after state conference. Forrest Swall and I submitted a motion to our state conference in Independence asking us to go on record in support of the Good Neighbor Pledge. I was shocked when the Saints turned it down by at least a 2-to-1 margin. Afterward, a pastor and when one congregation in the state came up to me and he was outraged. He thought that I had ruined the first state conference for some new members in his congregation. And I tried to cool him off, but he just kept going on and on. Was saying some really crazy stuff, which I haven't put in here. I said, "Hey, you drive by Harold House on your way home from work every day. Why don't you have to work one of these days this week? Just stop by and we'll talk some more." He said, "Okay, I will. And if that doesn't work, I'm prepared to test you physically." Now, I don't recall any other time that I've been challenged to a fight over church policy by a pastor or anyone in the priesthood, male or female, or any of the councils of the church, high or low, standing, sitting, or prone. While this pastor was castigating me right that night after state conference, a good friend, a religion major graduate from Grayson in my time, 1 year ahead of me, came up, and he was coming up to thank me for making my effort. He was so shocked at the pastor's reaction that he never set foot in our church again. Okay, the last one, I'm about to close here. Number 20, the worst letter we ever received was from Columbus, Ohio, not from the Deep South. Most of these letters came from a variety of places, but the worst we ever got was Columbus. He had published Dr. King's speech at Oslo, accepting the Nobel Peace Prize, a great speech, along with a photo of him. Soon we received an anonymous letter. He said, and I'm not going to sanitize the language. I think that often detracts from the actual impact of it. He wrote, "Why did you put that nigger's picture in the Herald? He's a fancy skunk and someone's going to shoot him one of these times." Well, 3 days, 3 years later they did. Then he closed, "A nigger will never be as good as a white man." That's not the only time I heard that final expression made. In my view, the church has come a long way on race from the days of those first two presidents I mentioned. But fortunately, the last three, Wally B. Smith, Grant, and Steve, are much better, much more enlightened on these subjects. You folks out here in the West, in the Western Zion, had a huge struggle over the issue of race, which often played out in the media. Some RLDS folks like to compare your record with our record, and they conveniently whitewashed our record. And I always felt like puking when they did that. But Bishop Walter Johnson was absolutely right. We've always had racial problems where we've had blacks, and we hadn't had very many blacks. And we had no reason to cast any stones at Utah or any place else. Most issues are usually more complex than racial discrimination and segregation. Other issues usually involve more gray areas. But when battling the racist, you're automatically on the side of the angels, despite our own many imperfections. I wasn't a hero for entering this struggle. I was an editor of church publications. There was no question beside the gospels on, and so I had to speak. And the real heroes were the thousands of black people who joined the struggle. They are the ones who had faced years of dehumanization. For many African Americans, it was a very dangerous thing to enter this fray. Most of them were very reluctant. They knew they were really risking their lives as well as jobs and other things. About 50 men and women, mostly black, gave their lives. Despite many anonymous phone calls and snotty letters, I never felt physically threatened, not even by that pastor. These are easy battles for us white folks. So I want you to know that I'm not a hero, and I'm serious about that. The blacks who risk their lives were the heroes. So I'll close by echoing my granddaughter. I'm not bragging. I'm not bragging. Just reporting. Thank you.
We've got about 15 minutes. If you've got questions, come up to this microphone. And if it's not on, just flip the little.
Is that way you'll be on the recording that people buy?
Yeah.
Can you hear me okay? A bunch of years ago, Lester Bush made the statement that the most persistent theme in Mormon thought about blacks and whites was anti-miscegenation, the issue that was resolved in Lubbock versus Virginia. And one of the things that some of us were especially delighted with, the December 2013 statement the church had done, it is about all the rationalizations of the Christian exclusion policy, but they also completely disavowed the idea that there was any difficulty with interracial marriage. Mm-hmm. I was just curious as to whether you folks have had a similar moment of truth on that issue. Because, as you know, there are still lots and lots of people in this country, even today, who are against interracial marriage.
Oh, yeah. No. Well, as I understand it, too, I think that's the first time the LDS first president has ever admitted the mistake. I've always been frustrated. I talked to LDS people who said, well, they want to make angle. Well, we're all right now. And it's as if it was all right before. I love the line, if any of you saw the Book of Mormon play that was popular on Broadway.
Jesus, mine.
he's surrounded. He's this naive missionary. He hadn't read the Book of Mormon before. And he's reading, the black skin thing. And he... So missionary nervously says, "God changed his mind about black people in 1978. And that's what you had the feeling the church believed until that editorial, whatever it was you said. So, I'm pretty sure I read it and thought that was well done, you know, from where they've been. That was a big step forward. I remember in 2012, I kept thinking, I love Mitt Romney. I love George Romney. I was in Michigan. He was great on civil rights, and that was a big domestic issue, and his church was still pre-78. And that's why I admired him, and I might have voted for him if he'd been the nominee. But Mitt is no George. And I kept thinking, Mitt, admit, and just do like your dad, admit your church is wrong on something, and race and polygamy would be two easy ones. It wouldn't cost you anything. You know, maybe a few church members might not vote for you, but you already got 90% or something. And Mitt did not learn the right lessons from his father. From as far as the earliest church, there's been no explicit. We would have to say, I guess, that even though we began ordaining blacks in 1885, sure, Walter Johnson was right. We've often had problems. I don't know of any statement from a big leader saying that, but they did move away from the silly things they were doing in the 60s. And it all started when George Romney ran for governor, as far as the Saints putting out these crazy editorials.
You mentioned that one of the speakers that you brought up, you mentioned three speakers. One was a black pastor
From Florida.
From a segregated congregation, was that RLDS
yes.
congregation?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And so you actually had segregated congregations?
In some, you know, we didn't have very many blacks. We didn't have very many blacks in the South, but... And early on, some of our earliest converts were from that area of the Florida Panhandle, and across the line in Alabama. I'm a good friend of Bill Blue's daughter, the man that wrote that great, the pastor that wrote that great article in Stripe. And she said that in order for me to be able to go to church, to be able to go to camps, reunions and youth camps and so forth, my parents had to go as cooks. Because unless you were there as servile, I suppose janitor, custodian too, or whatever, but anyway, that's the only way we could go. And also in the churches, when they went to the white church for like a district conference or something, they would either rope off a section in the back corner, or they'd be told that's where you sit. In fact, Bill Blue Sr. once went to the white congregation because a missionary was preaching there, and he wanted to hear him. And the pastor said, well, no, Brother Blue, you sit out here in the hall and listen from, because we got some potential converts coming tonight, and they might be upset if you sit in the room. So Gwen Blue, the daughter, she said, as a little kid, I was kind of afraid that the law might come, we'd always be told it's the law. Well, it's the law, but it doesn't really apply to religious organizations. I was always afraid the law would come breaking in and arrest us all if we weren't sitting in our proper place. But Gwen, one time at reunion, They're taking the kids swimming in the town in a swimming pool. She got a suit on. I'm really happy to go swimming. And about to get on the bus, and this man said, no, Gwen, you can't go. She was just pressed upon him. The white appointee from the north, who was assigned there, the darlings, John and Edith, I think it's darling, they saw this, and they came over, and they comforted her. Later on, she's a member of the Standing High Council in the church, a high priest, and she preaches at our elderly home in Independence. And she tells this story. Afterward, John Darling was still alive, and he was living there, and he came up, and she was delighted to see. This man was so helpful to her.
Bill, I'm curious as to how proactive or not the faculty at Graceland was during those years of the 60s and 70s in civil rights.
Yeah, I wasn't there until 60, at Graceland until 66 when I left Herald House. But I know there were a decent number of liberal faculty who did things like write letters. There probably weren't any street protests in Lamona because it's such a small town, rural community. But I know several of them wrote stuff in the Herald just like I did and so forth, or engaged in conversations. Unfortunately, Grayson had very few blacks during that period of 60 to 66 when I was at Herald House. That's when Gwendolyn Blue came to Grayson for 2 years. She never was asked for a date by a white guy. The only time she ever had a date was when their house, their floor, would be having a big, big party, and they could all invite a guy. And so that's the only time. But anyway, the faculty, some of them, it was a fairly liberal faculty in the 60s. not quite so much now, although still pretty soft. Still quite a few liberal faction members. Yeah.
Bill, you read about the congressman from Georgia. What's his name? Was it the Freedom Rides?
Andrew Young. I'm sorry, that's another hero from Atlanta. John Lewis.
John Lewis.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah. The question was, do I know John Lewis, the congressman from Alabama? Go ahead.
Have you ever read his books about how he's forgiven the people that beat him up and threw acid down his back? He's kind of a mystic. He's really...
He's great.
Yeah.
I have a friend that he was asking, did John Lewis, did I ever read what John Lewis has written about forgiving these people that beat him up? And I know he has because I've read a lot of articles on it. I've seen news cover all, he's been in several videos of civil rights movements, so I'm fairly familiar with it. Our congressman from our neighbor, from lives 3 miles from me, Leonard Boswell, former congressman for 16 years. Leonard just found John Lewis a hero. I mean, he was in awe of John Lewis.
He's amazing.
He went to Selma with John Lewis one time. Every year they have a reenactment, or at least a memorial of that. And Leonard went with Glenn down there. So yeah, he's the biggest hero in the Congress.
He's kind of a mystic because he forgave them all.
Yeah, he called. He had long conversations with George Wallace on the phone, and forgiven him. And George said, "No, John, I didn't mean to hurt anybody." You know, George Wallace by this time had real repentance. Though you can always read it either way, but that's not the first time I mixed up the two. One time I was in Congress, you know, walking through the halls below, and all of a sudden I ran into a black guy, and I thought I recognized it, and I said, "Oh, hi, Andy." I thought it was Andrew Young. It was John Lewis. Yeah,
Bill,
this is Paul Toscano speaking.
I just wanted to know how you reconcile. I mean, Wallace Smith was a racist, and yet, you know, we have them in our church, two prophets that are racist.
Yeah.
It seems consistent with the gospel. And they have these offices, and they are entitled to divine illumination, but they appear to be so unenlightened. So how do you reconcile? I mean, I'm interested in your... I mean, I have my way of reconciling it, too, but I'd like to hear how you...
Yeah, and I'll be interested in yours later, but I'll give you mine now. I think a big difference is W. Wallace Sr., he graduated from college, I believe, at Mizzou after going to Grayson in the early 20s. And those were times when all whites thought blacks were inferior. And he became a hardware salesman and other kinds of jobs like that. And he wasn't very active in the church until he recognized probably his brother, half-brother Israel, told him, "Hey, Wallace, kind of get in shape to be my successor." That's a guess on my part. But anyway, he had a very brief period as a pastor in Portland, and he was called to be an apostle. He wasn't that well educated. Now, Wally B., his son, he went to Grayson, then went to KU, got his degree, and then went to KU Medical School. And when I interviewed him 10 years ago, Wally B. said, "I really appreciate the scientific method. You always want hard data." And then when he became, I suspect, just again, I'm speculating here, but I suspect when his father told him, "Okay, I want you to replace me," I suspect Wallace said, "Okay, I'm an ophthalmologist now." He was my ophthalmologist when I lived in Des Moines. I mean, in Independence. I suspect Wallace said, "I need some time to prepare. I'm not educated." Wallace had written a fairly orthodox article in the Herald in 1967, I think it was. He told me they probably asked me to do it because I wouldn't have volunteered it. And it's very, very just typical orthodox RLDS. But now in 76 to 78, he's tutored by professors at St. Paul's School of Theology. He does a lot of world traveling to get acquainted with the church in Africa and other places. So he saw education as very important. I mean, I look at the education he must do to become a doctor. But now I want at least 2 years to prepare to become a prophet. I mean, he'd only been an assistant pastor and a member of the Standing Council. He had some church activities for several years, but that's not very good. I think our current president is the most prepared for the job because he's been kind of everywhere in previous assignments and really came up through the system, as did Grant, but Grant came up through Independence. Steve Easy has been all over the church prior to becoming Independence. But anyway, yeah, education I think is the key for W. Wallace Smith. Well, I'm sorry, Wallace Jr.
Is that your phone?
Nope.
Oh, it's the conference room. So my question is kind of along that same line between the divide between Wallace and Willoughby, and wondering if that reflects a change in the demographics of the RLDS Church as well, or if it's more just this generational divide, or just the education. Do you have any insight on that?
Yeah. In my book, soon to be published within the next century or so, on the schism in the 1980s, I identified three reasons why the church went through such major changes, and most of them occurred during Wallace's time, some on his initiative and some he supported, but not necessarily initiated them. And I identified three reasons. One is the education, and a lot of people went to seminary. I was a third RLDS graduate from that Methodist seminary next door. And I hid the fact that I was going to seminary. I didn't want to tell anybody. I only told anybody if they asked me, then I'd have to tell them. But because I knew I was unpopular. What do we have to learn from this Methodist, you know? But secondly, the same period in the 60s, the church sent missionaries into non-Christian parts of the world because of contacts. A lot of them because of contacts our soldiers had made after World War II. But then thirdly, it's the socioeconomic thing. You know, after World War II, the GI Bill, and then the federal government, thank you for their actions back then, made all sorts of things possible for education and other things. And so they created, and the naval labor unions, they created the middle class. And once you had middle class status, you might be able to afford college. So, I think education, the socioeconomic stratification that comes in time as the church becomes a little more middle class, a little more educated, a little more prosperous. If anybody wants to correct me on any of these, we got some independents and our well-known RLDS people. We got presidents of 70, and we got headquarters officials here. And so anybody, I'd be ready to stand corrected. And I'll be humble about it and repent as soon as I... Good to hear from Margaret.
One of the problems I see in the LDS church right now is there's this assumption of, oh, we don't have racism anymore because we took care of that, right? Mm-hmm. Oh, we had the revelation and it's not a problem anymore. Do you see that attitude in the community of Christ? Are people sensitive now to racial issues and the idea that perhaps we could still have racism? Do you see this as still an issue?
Well, you know, we vary so much from congregation to congregation and region. And certainly in my Lamoni congregation, if there's anybody that harbors these feelings, they keep their mouth shut. And that's unfortunate, I suppose, because we'd really like to know if they got problems with it. I'm sure in the South and some areas in the North there are people, but, you know, some people, I don't agree with this approach, some people will just shut up when they think they're in the minority or not, and I'm going to use a stupid term here, if they're not politically correct. I assume there is, but I don't see evidence of it. Yeah. Well, yeah, but just one more thing. Yeah, no racism in the LDS Church after 1978. Yeah, how long did McConkie's Mormon Doctrine, how long was it on the bookshelves here and elsewhere? 2011, 2012, or something like that?
Finally got rid of it,
but yeah, 40 years after that.
We had our lesson in the Aaronic Priesthood Manuals about interracial marriage, and there was a quote from Spencer Kimball about, you got to marry within your same race. Those manuals weren't replaced until like a year and a half ago.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, and while a lot of teachers would skip that or play it down, a lot of people felt like, you know, if you have to read everything that's in the book and you're reading quotes from Mormon doctrine and you're reading quotes from, you know, these racist quotes, what are we teaching our children?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And to try and expand that view to everybody and cut off this racism that, oh yeah, it was done in 1978, but then look at what are our policies on immigration and how do we treat the people in our neighborhoods differently than anyway.
Yeah. One disadvantage you folks have is that you will uphold these old statements, you know, by Spencer B. Kimball, that's in the 70s, you know, and people before that, I suppose, where, and I'll just give you an example, and how it really bugged me, and we probably got to quit when I finish it, but I wrote an article, I gave a paper at Sunstone, and published it in Sunstone, I think it was, or Dialogue, in the mid-70s, And I was writing about, the theme was up from literalism, that is up from literal translations of the Bible, I mean literal interpretations of the Bible. And so I wrote to my old friend Bob Matthews, first Mormon scholar I ever met at BYU, you know, Bible guy down there. And I said, what do you use for your basic text in Bible? We use Prentice Hall's two volumes, Old and New Testament, they're classic, probably the leading one around the country. And he sent me these three workbooks. When I flipped through them, and about half of the controversial issues in biblical, and I used to teach Bible at Graceland, about half the controversial issues in biblical scholarship were ignored. And the others, like, say, Deuteronomy, 2 Isaiah, it was dealt with, yeah. President Joseph A. Smith settled this in 1909 with his editorial in the Ensign magazine or whatever it was. And so they were so often just looking to church authority. Well, we don't do that. We look to Wayne Ham or, well, Tony Chavala Smith is our kind of our key biblical scholar. Now, we ask Tony, what's the deal on 2 Isaiah? You know. So anyway, we don't venerate these dead prophets or living ones either.
And I think our time is up. It is 9:30. There's a little red button on the very bottom.
Oh, okay. Well, thanks for coming.
Yeah.